Hey everyone, it's David Chen here with another bonus episode preview. This is our conversation about Netflix's Three Body Problem Season 1. We discuss the entire season, what we liked about it, what we didn't like about it. Patrick and I are going to be ramping up our bonus episodes, and when I post a bonus episode preview to the main podcast feed, like the one you're listening to right now, it's going to be a big chunk of it. You're going to get a really good sense of what the conversation's like. It's not going to be just like 5 or 10 minutes. But if you want to listen to the rest of it and support this podcast and help to keep it going long into the future, it's very easy to do that by going to decodingtv.com and becoming a paid subscriber. Thanks to everyone at decodingtv.com who's a paid subscriber who helps to keep this podcast going. And we hope you enjoy this bonus episode preview. Thanks. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV, a podcast about television. I am David Chen. Joining me, as always, Patrick Klepek. How's it going today?
Hello. It's good. How are you, David?
I am excited to dive into Three Body Problem with you today here on the podcast. This conversation will be about Three Body Problem on Netflix Season 1. We're going to start by sharing whether or not we think you should watch it, some very high-level overall thoughts, and then we will dive into some spoilers and a detailed, not necessarily a recap, but a sort of summation of some of the major plot beats that have happened during the later parts of the season. Of course, if you want to hear the first part of our conversation about the show, check out Decoding TV at podcast.decodingtv.com. We're also available wherever your podcast can be found. And find our videos across Instagram and Threads and TikTok at Decoding TV. Also, would love to hear your thoughts at decodingtv@gmail.com. You know, Patrick Klepek, we did get a few emails in response to our conversation about the first few episodes of Three Body Problem saying, hey, Patrick Klepek, the hard sci-fi, ponderous show that you're looking for exists, and it is actually the other adaptation of Three Body Problem that's available on a streaming service. People may or may not be aware that there's been another adaptation that's, I think, streaming on Prime Video.
It's an actual Chinese adaptation, yeah, I believe, yeah. That goes for, I don't know how much of the same ground it does or doesn't cover. I don't believe it goes through the entire trilogy, but it's like 30 episodes. Like it's a much longer production than this one.
Yeah. And so Patrick Klepek, were you moved by any of these messages? Is that something you might check out?
I don't know that I need to go through this material a second time, which is not necessarily indicative of how I feel about this show and what it did or didn't accomplish. Right. But I think when I saw that email, I was like, oh, well, maybe that's like a fun six to eight episode romp. It was like 30 episodes. Like, well, yep. I'm out. Like, that's just, it's much more likely that I will like download the audiobook of the original novel and like fill in some of the gaps, like revisit how the adaptation went than actually do that. But I'm glad it exists. And depending on whether this gets a season two, how you felt about the adaptation, if you chose to go down this path with us, it's nice to know that there is an alternative depending on your tastes and kind of the approach to telling the story.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, sometimes I question your commitment to Sparkle Motion, Patrick Klepek, but no, seriously, Three Body Problem is probably something you don't need to spend an additional because if there's a second season,
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're probably going to watch that one on Netflix, so correct. You don't need to spend an additional 30 hours. But yeah, there is a 30-episode adaptation that's directed by Yang Li and Vincent Yang by Tencent that is available right now on Prime Video if you want to watch it. And it is a different take on the material. We have not watched it, but a lot of people have praised its virtue. So I wanted to shout that out. And thanks to everyone who wrote into decodingtv@gmail.com for mentioning that. All that said, Patrick Klepek, let's talk about Three Body Problem on Netflix, starting right now.
As children, we fear the dark. Anything might be out there. The unknown troubles us.
There are those who say we should not inquire too closely into who else might be living in that darkness. Better not to know.
All right. So let's talk about Three Body Problem on Netflix season one. Overall thoughts, Patrick Klepek, do you think people should watch this show?
I do. I don't think it's a home run. It's probably more of a, from extending the metaphor, a double, mostly on the strength of the sci-fi concepts therein that I found deeply compelling, but the characters fall flat. And I think that's something we'll get into quite a bit as we talk about this show.
I think this show is mostly terrible, but but it has...
If I could spin a wheel on every time I get on a podcast with David to talk about something, then what word are we landing on today? It's just that the thesaurus were terrible, and then we're just... and then there's Shogun.
Okay, that is not fair, Patrick Klepek. There have been other shows... I liked The Continental more than you did, okay? Anyway.
Strong phrase.
I think the show is mostly terrible, but... it does have some really compelling sci-fi concepts. So if you are like just a really hardcore sci-fi fan, or if you're a fan of the books, I do think it's inherently interesting, the decisions that have been made to adapt this to an 8-episode series. And therefore, I'd recommend it to those people. For everyone else, not a show I can recommend, unfortunately. So those are some quick overall thoughts on whether you should watch the show. Patrick, we're gonna expand on those right now before we dive into our recap and conversation about what actually happened. But yeah, what were some of the things that you thought this show did particularly well?
Well, it's kind of like, I think as I explained it in when we discussed the first three episodes on the main show, was for me, oftentimes sci-fi and horror, I can look at them differently than I do all different types of storytelling, in which like there is my ability to react sort of like on a guttural level to an interesting idea can get me a long way there. And I love that when it's paired with excellent storytelling, great characters, but I am able to actually separate those things out and can go a surprisingly long way as long as those core elements, the ideas, or in a horror film, like great effects or a cool creature, like that can get me a lot of the way there. Maybe just as a result of having watched so much of these different types of genres that I find myself able to separate that. But here it was like, you know, the sophons, like the idea of like this, like quantum realm, object surrounding the world, projecting displays to the entire, like there's just all these incredibly cool things that are captured enough in the show to capture my imagination that I'm mostly compelled to see what else does this author have. I find myself interested to see if this original story has, in this first part in this trilogy, has this many interesting ideas. Surely there must be more interesting ideas in the second and third, which is why people often rave about like the books as a series, as opposed to, the first book's pretty good and then yada yada. And so I have problems, I have qualms, deep qualms with the adaptation, but I want to see those ideas. And so we've talked about on the most recent episode, like, will this get a second season? I think Netflix should plow ahead. I think they should give it a chance. I'd like to see what that was like in an adaptation. But if we get the cancellation notice, where I'm at with this show is that I've already been reading up on, there's been guides online. They're like, hey, if Netflix doesn't renew this, here's how you transition to listening to the audiobook right. of the second book. Here's where these characters, here are characters invented whole cloth. Here are characters that were combined. Here are the timelines that aren't going to make as much sense to you because the adaptation is taking storylines and characters from books two and three and tying them up with the time. So
right, yeah.
I'm ready to go down that path.
Wow.
I'll stick with the adaptations if Netflix greenlights a season two, but I'm captured enough by these core concepts, especially like alien invasions are my catnip and like context stories are the thing that gets me in the door on almost anything. I have to see how this plays out. And at this point, I'm willing to I'll go through door A, which is the show, and if that door is closed, it's what's nice is, unlike a lot of other things on Netflix, I have a door B. I can still find resolution to those stories somewhere else.
So the show is strong enough that you are committed to this path, which is a compelling testimony for the show, I would say. So
that's a mix. I think the adaptation is strong enough that I would like to see it find its footing, and I think there's evidence that it could do that, find that footing in its second season. It's also just a practical thing. Like, it is easier for me to sit down, like, in my life to watch an 8-episode television show than it is to read a book or even listen to a book. Like, it's it is on some level, like, I don't mean so to immediately dismantle your point.
It's the path of least resistance, basically.
It is the path of least resistance. And again,
it's just this kind of sci-fi entertainment slurry that you're going to just pound straight into the gullet.
If there's other things like the Sofon and less things like the VR helmet, then, you know, hopefully that's what awaits me in the books and seasons ahead.
I will agree with you that the thing that I love most about the show is how it conveys some, not all, of its sci-fi concepts, right? It's introducing all these fascinating ideas about quantum computing and how you travel faster than the speed of light and how you would get an actual man-made object, a physical ship, to 1% light speed and all these other things that I'm like, oh, wow, I've never thought about that. It obviously is a show that prizes science, which is I never thought in my life I'd live to the day when that would be a bold stance, that science is a good thing. But I think, you know, I agree that that is something that we should praise and elevate in our society. There's a rash of anti-intellectualism in America right now, and I think it's very dangerous for us. And so that's what I think is, you know, works best about the show is are the core sci-fi concepts and how effectively some of them are conveyed. Everything else about the show, not great, in my opinion. The characters are pretty bland and forgettable overall, with the possible exception of Jin Chung. And the storytelling, I would describe as pretty disastrous. I think that pacing-wise, season one of Three Body Problem is all over the place. Like, seemingly nothing happens for the first, like, five episodes. And then seemingly, like, years occur in like, within the course of, like, one or two episodes, right? And, like, or very little time passes, right, for, like, some episodes. You're flashing back and forth, but, like, very little time passes in the main storyline. And then, like, all of a sudden, like, all this stuff happens, and it feels like they're jamming all this plot into a very brief amount of time. I think the pacing is almost catastrophic for this show. And so I just think from a storytelling perspective, it ended up being pretty rough. Doesn't mean there's nothing in the show worth enjoying or praising. Just that as a season of television, I don't think it really works. So that's my thoughts. Patrick Klepek, any response to that before we start diving into the plot details?
No, I broadly agree. I don't think I'm as down in it as you are. And it's,
yeah, you called it a double, right? Not a home run, but a double. I might be like a single, and maybe the guy is starting to steal the second base. You know, that's kind of
part of it's to be how much you respond to the individual concepts, right? Like, how much does that capture you? And it really, like, every time there was a new, like, bwong sort of, like, I was right back in it. And I'm with you. I wish there was more, I don't know, coherence to the characters, why they exist, their dynamic. We'll obviously get into all the stuff with Will, which is odd. And it's a show without having a lot of understanding of the storytelling, the character structure, the character dynamics of the book. It's very much like, all right, we've got these cool ideas. Now, like, how do we put characters around these ideas and get from one idea to the next? And I just don't know that the show succeeded all that well at making that part work. And I think that's where, to varying degrees, that's where it falls apart for you and I from that angle, is just, I do not think the characters and the relationships seem especially credible. And I think it's not helped by often this feeling of we're moving to the next big sci-fi idea, and the show seems more interested in that than it is in the characters. And so the characters orbit these ideas, I think, at the absence of finding real depth to any one of them.
Yeah, and I think if you conceive of the show as just a sci-fi concept delivery mechanism, it's fine, but I have other more efficient means of doing that, Patrick Klepek. I have, like, YouTube videos I can watch instead, you know? The reason I watch a dramatization is to have a good story told with compelling characters and a satisfying narrative. I could watch PBS, I could watch the History Channel, I could watch other things if I want to stew about things like the Fermi paradox or whatever. But I watch a narrative show, a big budget show, to get more than that. And I don't feel like the show really delivered on that front. So, but in the conversation to come, we will see how much you agree with me on that front. So here we go. All right, let's talk about what actually happened in the show itself. When we last left off in Three Body Problem, there were a few separate plot lines. In the 1960s, we saw a woman named Yewinche trying to figure out a way to contact aliens and tell them to come to Earth to take it over. She eventually links up with a billionaire named Mike Evans, and the two of them create an organization dedicated to welcome these aliens who are called the Santee. They are due to arrive on this planet in around 400 years. They're fleeing their own unstable solar system, which had three suns. And while they were initially hoping to conquer Earth, they soon realized that humanity will have advanced beyond their abilities by the time they arrive. So they sent these proton-sized supercomputers called Sophons to fuck with us and our science and ensure that we cannot resist them. The Sophons have some abilities, like they can fly around the planet in seconds. They can make people mass hallucinate. They can also sync up with their information that they have in the Santee fleet, so everyone in the Santee fleet knows what's going on. So that's one of the major plot lines. And I do want to say, again, to praise the show, when they're there's all these mysteries that the show sets up, right? What's causing the hallucinations or the people, you know, seeing a countdown or all this stuff? What's causing the problems with the proton accelerators? How are the Santee able to communicate with people on Earth, even though they are theoretically light years away? And it's impossible to have communication that goes that far that's synchronous. Like, how do any of these things happen? And the show does explain these things. And when it's explaining the Sophons and how the Sophons work, and it's like putting up all these dominoes of why is this? Why is this? Why is it? And it's just knocking them down. And that's like a very thrilling part of the show, is when they're explaining. It's like every single thing they're explaining is blowing your mind of like why
it feels very credible. I'm not sitting here like fact checking the science theory.
But it's like, protons have less mass than could they travel faster than light? That makes sense. You know, that seems like it sounds right.
It doesn't strain credibility in the context of the show, even if I can't speak to the science of it all. And that it feels like a very fun solution to these really grand, extraordinary problems that the show sets up for itself. I will say, I think one of the great failings of the show is you have this character. The show starts in the Chinese Cultural Revolution, some of the strongest parts of the show.
Yes. As we
have a character who, as a result of their experiences here, the death of their father, the going to a labor camp after the fact, has felt as they've seen the depths of humanity. Humanity is essentially not worth saving, or if they are worth saving, they need a solution that is beyond us. It is something almost godlike in comparison to humanity.
Right.
And chooses to condemn humanity to at least an encounter with people, species, creatures that are beyond our comprehension. And that is just such a... Who is this person? Why do they think this way? How did they get there? And I feel like this show goes just so surface level with that interiority, that decision making. It is trivialized down to my dad died and like I fucked up some emails and then my daughter killed herself. And now those are obviously tremendous traumas, but the journey this person goes on to make that decision. And then very quickly later in the season, when they seem to undergo a radical transformation of thought on their, like, it's just, I wanted that character ever more present with way more explanation into how they felt how they got there. And many times when we're transitioning to the Oxford Five, I'm wondering, could we just go back to her? Like, this decision is so monumental. How one arrives at this is so fascinating. And the show is just not that interested in unpacking it beyond these like really primary traumas that she experiences once as a young adult. And then, you know, once later in life with her daughter. And I just found the performance compelling, the character compelling, and just a real absence in characterization for the character that puts all of this in motion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, how dare you make me defend the show? But I will say that they do give you that scene where she kind of confronts the person who murdered her father. Mm-hmm. And she gets a real glimpse of the darkness of the human spirit there. And that felt sufficient motivation to me. That said, I think the actress who plays Yeo In-jae in the modern day, Rosalind Chow is her name, right?
Mm-hmm.
Very talented, would have loved to see more of her. And I can totally agree with you there. You're never going to get me to disagree that the show could have used more characterization for any of its characters. But I do think it gave, that was not the one that bothered me the most. I'll put it that way.
I mean, it really less bothered me, and maybe failure is too strong of a point, but I, with several other characters on the show, particularly in the Oxford Five, it's difficult for me to see where the depth is going to come from. You know what I mean? Like the characters are so paper thin that I'm not even sure how they're going to act as anything other than plot vehicles. Whereas you have a character like this that is given, I think, sufficient screen time, but it could have been a better, I think it would have been a better show with even more of it that explored her decision-making and how she arrived at it.
I'm going to put this out there. You know, this is an analogy I've used in the past, or an insight I've referred to in the past on some of my other podcasts, but I'm going to spoil the Zack Snyder movie Watchmen and also the Alan Moore graphic novel Watchmen, right? So are you familiar with, I assume, both of those, Patrick Klepek?
Yes.
Right. So
I did. I also thought about these touchstones when I was watching the show as well.
Well, I remember listening to an interview with the writer of the movie Watchmen, right? And so we're going to spoil the movie and the book. So basically what happens in that story is there's a character named Ozymandias who engineers what could be described as a false flag attack on planet Earth, like a catastrophic explosion that kills millions of people. And his idea behind doing that is to unite all these people around the planet and usher in a new era of peace. That's like why he does it. And in the novel, the way that he accomplishes this is by teleporting a gigantic alien squid from an extra dimension into, I think, New York City or something like
New York,
that. And it creates this explosion and tons of people die. The movie notably changes that. It changes it from extra-dimensional squid into, it's actually Dr. Manhattan, who is a godlike power with nuclear shape-shifting capabilities. He is the one that ends up killing, like being framed for killing all those people. And listening to the screenwriter talk about it, he said, you know, why did you make that? That's a pretty major change from the book. Like, why did you make that change? And he was saying, well, look, if you're watching the movie, you've already had to accept that there's this group of crime-fighting superheroes, and also that there's this guy named Dr. Manhattan who has all these superpowers. And we felt that asking the audience to accept yet another thing late on in the film about extra-dimensional giant squids would be like too much to ask of the audience.
Right.
Right. And so, therefore, we just made it something else that we've already asked the audience to accept. I feel like this show never stopped asking the audience to accept new things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I'm sure, a function of the book. So I'm not saying there, you know, but like, there's a reason why the book has been described as unfilmable, you know? It's because, and it starts with this Yeo In-jae thing where apparently someone from the alien race reached out and said, hey, don't reach out to us, because if you do, we're going to conquer you. And it's like, okay, is that person real? Is that like, mm-hmm. what is behind that? We, you know, maybe we'll find out in future episodes of the series. But like, that's number one thing to buy, is that we need to believe that A, there's an alien race that can destroy us all, and B, that they're trying to dissuade us from contacting them. But it starts right there. And so, yeah, and I agree, like, we need to buy that, and in order for Yeo In-jae's emotional journey to have any impact, we need to like accept all this stuff. And I don't know that the show did a particularly good job of that. That's that subplot, you know, which kind of feeds into that character development. So that's going to be a common theme you hear throughout this conversation is how much the audience can accept in this situation. But all right. You know, one thing I want to bring up, Patrick Klepek, is I am frustrated by how the show conveyed the Sofons' powers, because the Sofons have no mass, right? Like they're tiny, but they can, if you are subatomic, you can circumnavigate the world in less than 1 second, right? Like, so you can basically be everywhere, you know, and that's very potent. They can also apparently interfere with electronics and make people see things. If you have that ability, you're basically you basically have the ability to make everyone kill each other. Like, in my opinion, you basically have the ability to kill people or make people kill each other, make people see countdowns. Even if the countdown's not anything real, you can make people mass hallucinate some really upsetting shit. And apparently they decide not to exercise this power, but like that was one thing that always bothered me, is like the power is not fully defined, and to the extent that it is defined, it feels extremely powerful, like able to overcome literally any of our puny attempts at trying to counter them. I don't know if you felt that way, Patrick Klepek. Am I reaching here? What do you think?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting point. I don't disagree that the lack of definition on sort of like it's like borrow a superhero term, like the power set. Like, yeah, what are we working here? Like, what is the floor? What is the ceiling? And I think the floor is kind of defined, but unfortunately, the floor is everything, and then the ceiling is like, well, if the floor is everything, where does it stay? And they, you know, I think the show proposes at various points ways that they could try and mitigate like one of the Sofons, but you would still be dealing with a second Sofon that was able to accumulate and execute upon these really godlike powers to the entire human race. And
which was super cool. I love that whole like line of thinking of like, if we put a base on the moon, then like it's going to take 3 seconds for them to get from here to the, you know, like,
yeah, or like having the particle accelerators like operating slightly off bounce. I was like, those are some of those little sequences where they're explaining with what we have, what can we do to fuck with them?
Yeah.
Is some of my favorite stuff in the show is like, okay, they're arguably hundreds of thousands of years ahead of us technologically. We have tin cans. But if we put the tin cans just right, you know,
exactly.
That sort of stuff is really great. But I guess I agree with you, but I also didn't think about it too much is where landed with it. Is that if I sit here and like debated over, well, why wouldn't the Sofons just do this? That seems like a more, if they just want Earth, just kill us all remotely, you know what I mean?
You could have everyone hallucinate that, hey, I know they can't lie. That's a huge downside, but like have them burn in things into their retinas until everyone goes insane and then just sweep in and
if everyone was suddenly blind, like decided to be pretty fucked up. I don't know how it's gonna operate. So
it's implied they have the ability to like change autopilots on vehicles,
on cars.
I guess everyone crash into the sea. Like, you know. Anyway,
the line that I bought, which I think the show is being implicit about as opposed to explicit about, is just we can't fully understand their thinking. They have a reason for doing this or doing that. And for me, part of the reason I was able to sustain a suspension of disbelief for that, I think part of the reason I didn't think too hard about this was because there is source material, right? It's like, okay, there's a second book, there's a third book. Maybe those answers aren't satisfying. And I guess it's possible that the adaptation would, you know, possibly sully though, like those answers if I was to experience them in the book itself. But I choose to sort of just go with what's in front of me, one foot in front of the other, because, well, it was resolved in the book. And so I'm just not going to think too hard about why isn't it this way? Because, well, maybe that'll be explained in some way or another as the story goes along. But I agree with you, absent all that, like in the context of the show, it does seem sort of silly that like, ooh, we're going to, we're going to put some effects from The Ring onto a television and then appear as a video game samurai character. You know, I mean, some of it comes across as frankly a bit silly given how destructive they could be if they chose to be. I mean, because they essentially deploy like the Sam Raimi like first person effect of like the photon like moving itself around to some degree. And I would say in general, this is probably something we'll get into, the actual depiction of various sci-fi concepts in this show often does not feel as cool as what it's described as on paper. And I think the Sofans, like the actual manifestation of their technology, like, or how they move, how they navigate moment to moment, is one of those weaknesses of the show, for sure.
I think the show actually does an admirable job of explaining what the Sofans are, you know, and allowing you to wrap your head around that. But, you know, I've done some more reading about what happens in the books. I would be surprised if it is explained to our satisfaction in later iterations. That said, if you disagree, email us decodingtv@gmail.com. If my issues with the Sofans are valid or not for the duration of the series, it just, as presented in season one, it seems extremely silly that we're even having this conversation because the Sofans would just win automatically. Like it doesn't.
Well, it makes me wonder if it's one of those things that in the book, which can be more ponderous, and it's much easier to do exposition
in detail. It describes the Sofans' limitations. But like, again, from what we've seen, they're pretty freaking powerful.
They are.
No one seems to be like, it's kind of driving me. I feel like I'm taking crazy pills. Like, no one is acknowledging. Like, I feel like I'm standing in a street corner. Do you see how powerful these people are? Like, do you see what they're capable of? Like,
at least if they would ignite. Like, I think if I'm in that world, you discover this. If you were actually to think about how powerful they were, you would just get the gun and end it. I don't actually think you could put one foot in front of the other. It's one thing. Yes, aliens are coming. They're probably going to kill us. They're probably going to enslave like my great-great-great-grandchildren. But that's 400 years from now. And the show actually, I think, does a decent job of exploring the philosophical dynamic of near-term, long-term. Who you help and why you help and to what extent you do. But I guess part of it for me was just, can't think about that, man. Clearly they're not using the full power set. And thank God. I thank God every day they're not using the Sofans.
Okay. Fair enough. And I leave open the possibility that it's all going to be part of a grand plan why they didn't just kill us all. Mm-hmm. For sure. Fine. Fair enough. As presented, it struck me as there being some open questions about the Sofans. All right. Let's move on. One of my favorite sequences of the show, there's a really fun sequence where Mike Evans is reading Little Red Riding Hood to one of the Sofans while he's on the ship Judgment Day. And it is during the course of this reading that the Sofans realize that humans have the capability of lying. They have the capability to tell stories that aren't true. And lying is something the Santi can't do. And when they discover that humans can do this, they basically abandon Mike Evans, although they continue to maintain contact with a few Santi loyalists on Earth. I will say that my understanding, Patrick Klepek, and tell me if you disagree, is like the Sofans were always planning to conquer Earth regardless. Mm-hmm. Like the people like Mike Evans and Ye Win Che, they were just there to help facilitate that, but they were never going to not conquer Earth. That was kind of my interpretation.
There's a world where that line of thinking helps explain a little bit of the Sofan stuff, which is, could they use this to kill us all? Yes. But they actually seem like they want humanity to stick around. So they want us to be terrified. They'd like us to just stay here as we are.
Right.
No tech.
Right.
Like, so I think that might actually go a long way to explaining the Sofan stuff in this whole bit about the lie and the kind of change in their philosophy towards humanity is, we didn't understand your power set either. Lying just added, like, that's like an invincibility cloak that we didn't realize you could put on. I think it adds a fascinating, I wouldn't, for some people, that's like a bridge too far in terms of trying to conceptualize these aliens. What do you mean they can't? What do you mean they can't lie? But I just sort of take it at face value. It's like, okay, they can't lie. Like, that's a kind of an odd quirk of the Santi, but they say they can't lie and seems like they can't choose to do it. It's just not something their brains are capable of. They can conceptualize it, but cannot execute it, which is at least fascinating.
I do think it's interesting the way it's explained our technological progressions. Basically, humans progress at a far faster technological rate than the Santis, than the Santi, I guess is how you describe them. And the reason that we aren't more advanced than them today is because the Santi came from a planet or from a solar system where there was three suns, and every now and then their planet would get into a bad orbit in relation to these things, and there'd be an era of chaos and catastrophe, and it would wipe out all of their technological games. So they'd have to restart over and over again. So it took them millions of years to achieve the technological advancement that it took humans hundreds of thousands of years to achieve. And so even though they're far more advanced than us now, by the time they get to us, they're afraid that we'll be much more advanced than them. And I thought that was a very fascinating concept and well conveyed in the show as well. So anyway.
Which is just part of what I love about that is it flips the entire trope of the alien invasion premise on its head, which is always like, what, you know, you watch an Independence Day or any of this sort of like, how does humanity fight back? Oh, like they overlooked a computer virus in Independence Day, or oh, like, you know, signs of War of the Worlds, right. They didn't understand like an element of like how our atmosphere works. And I love the idea here, like, we are so much better than you, but shit, man, you're pretty good, and like if we give you too much time, you're gonna be better. It's just a really for them to be afraid.
You will be based on all current projections, you will be good enough, you know.
Correct. That's an interesting idea. We're afraid of you.
Right.
Even though we're invading you, is just that's the stuff where I'm like, oh, this this story is cooking. Like that is just interesting. Such a cool idea.
It for sure is interesting. Yeah. And that part of the story was conveyed well. Okay. Meanwhile, present day, we followed five characters, the Oxford Five, a few of whom are playing a video game that was a recruiting tool for the Santi. The Santi are looking for people loyal to their cause who they can use to manipulate world events. There are two groups of Santi loyalists. You know, they all know each other and they're together, but they're like in physically separate places. Ye Winche leads a group on the mainland. Mike Evans leads a group on a ship called Judgment Day. Jin Chung infiltrates the group on dry land and gets Ye Winche arrested. Meanwhile, in order to recover a hard drive full of all the info we have on the Santi, Thomas Wade employs the help of Augie's nanofibers to completely destroy the Judgment Day ship. This happens in episode 5. This is probably the emotional, technical, storytelling highlight / climax of the first season of the show is this sequence, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I did a lot of reading about this, Patrick Lepik, because as presented in the show, it doesn't make much sense. why you would need to do this horrifying thing in order to kill these people. Like there's many easier ways to kill Mike Evans if that is your goal, right? Apparently in the book it is explained that their target is the hard drive that Mike Evans is holding when he dies, and they are afraid that if they invade the ship via other means, like let's say we send a SWAT team in there or whatever, or we blow it up, you know, like if we send a SWAT team in there, Mike Evans will realize what's going on and he'll have time to destroy the hard drive, right? Like
that, I think they do talk about that on the show.
Okay. That's true. But I think it's like further elaborated on that, like the best way to get this thing is via slicing the entire ship and therefore everyone on board, including
and
children.
And really hoping that one of those spots doesn't line up with the hard drive, because
apparently also like if a nano fiber cuts through the hard drive, it's like relatively easy to reconstitute. Is kind of like,
oh, I don't feel like the show conveyed that well, because
that's the worst case scenario is the nanofiber cuts through that hard drive. And it's like, that's better than it blowing up, you know?
All right. Because my whole thought was like, it'd be one thing if they ran the nanofibers through and they knew exactly where he was sitting. And it's like, we've calculated like this trajectory makes sense to us. Like, it'll be like, Instead, I was like, well, he's running all over this ship. Like, if he runs through those nanofibers, cuts the hard drive in half, yeah. Why'd we kill all these kids, man?
Well, apparently, this is the thing. Apparently, there were no kids on the ship in the book. That was just added to spice things up a little bit.
I thought that was an effective addition. I will say, like, if you're like that, kids are like killing kids is fucked up. And they don't actively show children being maimed.
They do not show a child getting sliced.
We see the result of that. There's a leg later. But you know, I got kids. I'm not against like kids being used as a sort of a device to sort of heighten the emotions. And it made sense to me that there would be kids on, you know, our common conceptualizations of sort of like mass cults. Like it would make sense that on this ship they are having schools and there would be children. So none of that read all that poorly to me. And I found that mostly for me, it was like, as soon as it started, I'm like, You're not gonna. I mean, I know.
Yeah, it is one of those things where, like, are you gonna do this?
I was like, I know you're gonna kill the kids. Are you gonna show it? And like, that became far more than like the drama actually unfolding. Was like, I want to see how far this show is willing to go. Do it. I'm like staring the show down. Do it. Kill the kid. I'll watch. Did you make some poor fucking animator have to spend a whole week animating the decapitation of a 7-year-old? I'll watch it. I'm here. And they don't do that. But I thought it was, if over the top, it was like kind of, it was a tremendous visual effects sequence to watch unfold.
It is a tour de force sequence. It is an incredible sequence. Like, it's the one thing people will remember from the show. I will say, like, tonally, it doesn't really fit in too much of the rest of the show, in my opinion. Like, it's not like Shogun, where every episode has someone dying brutally. Like, this is not like that show. So it feels very kind of out of place tonally than the rest of the show for me. But it's an incredible sequence and really well executed. And just one of those things where the show explains, oh, hey, this woman made this very tough nanofiber. And you kind of think to yourself, boring, I don't care. And then you realize, hey, if we stretch...
So David and I are always shouting at the television, like, boring.
Thumbs down, you know. But it's like, hey, if you stretch even one of these things out in front of a ship, the damage it could do would be freaking catastrophic. And that's just a really wild concept to contemplate. The whole sequence is just like the editing of it, the way it like slowly reveals what's going on. There's that guy on top of the, and then you, like, as the viewer, you're like, you're just imagining what's happening. You don't, because you can't see the nanofiber, right? So it's a really tremendous sequence. And if you're into that kind of horror gore stuff, it's almost worth watching the show just to see them execute something this gruesome, you know, the balls, the audacity of it is something to witness.
Well, cause there was a different way to shoot it. You know what I mean? Like it didn't,
shown it at all. They could have just shown it.
Or like, you could have just seen the ship, right? You could easily imagine a different version. That's just like up above.
Yeah.
And then you see it cutting through it. You hear screams. We watch maybe the guy they're after.
Maybe you don't
dies.
Even see it. You don't even see it. You just hear the screams and people watching the monitors, and you don't even hear it. You know?
No, it's very indulgent. But I do think. I mean, this show is really lacking in finding appropriate motivations for its main character, especially the ox. And like, basically, Augie doesn't work unless, and you could still argue that Augie doesn't work. I think, sadly, a ton of that actually comes down to the performance. I don't particularly like the actor who is Augie. I don't think the scripts are helping, but I don't think she's elevating the scripts.
She's gotten a lot of flack. Isaac Gonzalez is the name of the actor. She's gotten a lot of flack. I think it's mostly a script issue. I think there are actors that can elevate a poor script.
That's mostly what I'm saying. I think there are. She's not being given much and isn't able to punch that up on her own. That's not inherently her fault, where it's like, you know what, the key to being a good actor is to being great with a shitty script. And like, I feel like she's working with tough material, but the arc of where her character goes in the latter half of the season, I think it's understandable why they spend so much time making this seem so horrific, because you need to understand why she's unwilling to take the steps being asked later on. And it's because you kind of have to sit with how graphic and gruesome and awful the con, because so much of some of the science that's happening in this show, even the big motivating factor for the end, is like, well,
it's up there in space. Seems bad,
but you know, like you're kind of disconnected from it. Whereas this is right in front of you.
What if the real monsters are here on Earth, Patrick Kleber? What if the real human killers?
Damn.
What if the real murderers are other humans?
Do you ever think about that?
I still think you didn't need to. You could still have all that without showing it as graphically as they did. But you know, whatever.
I'm glad they did. I enjoyed the sequence.
Yeah, it's an incredible sequence. It's an incredible sequence. People will talk about it for a long time. It's going to be one of those sequences. So, good on them. Patrick Klepek, one thing this show does enable you to do is, have you ever suspected that you and your four friends are literally the five most important people on the planet?
I mean, I don't like to talk about it. It feels like bragging.
I think it is kind of funny. That was a bonus episode preview of Decoding TV's conversation about Netflix's Three Body Problem Season 1. To listen to the rest of the episode, go to decodingtv.com and become a paid subscriber. Thanks.